Good afternoon. You're listening to KFSK News for Wednesday, February 11th. I'm Olivia Rose. A load of young growth lumber harvested from the Tongass National Forest boarded the Kennecott Ferry from Petersburg to Sitka late last month. Its final destination was an outdoor learning shelter being constructed behind Sitka's Pacific High School. KCAW's Hope McKenney rode with the shipment from the ferry terminal to the construction site and has this report.
If you want to ride in, you're more than welcome to. It's not the best ride in town, but...
I climb up into the large white flatbed truck, its loud diesel engine roaring around me. The bed is stacked with hundreds of young-growth Sitka spruce boards harvested from Mitkoff Island in the Tongass National Forest.
But I think there's about 3,500 to 4,000 feet on the truck right now.
Brett Martin co-owns Alaska Timber and Truss in Petersburg, but his home base is Sitka. The company aims to provide local lumber for southeast and south central Alaska. Martin says this is the second batch of lumber shipped to Sitka on the ferry for this project. To get it ready, they let the spruce air dry for a year after harvest before it went into the kiln to dehydrate for about 6 more days. Martin says it's exciting to be part of this build.
It's going to be around for decades, if not longer, you know. I mean, it may be just like one of the houses around here, the Bishop's house or somebody else's, you know, that's going to be here for a century or more, you know, because they take care of it. And it'll be, you know, a start. It'll be the first of its kind. I don't know of anybody else that have focused on building a big timber structure like that here in Alaska.
So. We park at the construction site behind Pacific High School. I exit the truck and watch as a large forklift begins to lift loads of lumber off the flatbed and places them next to the frame of a building they'll soon add a roof to. Andrew Tomes stands nearby, his two schnauzers by his side. Tomes is the executive director of the Sitka Conservation Society, a collaborator on the project.
These boards come from some of the first timber sales that are young growth timber sales, and it's a mill that's experimenting with how we can use that resource, what we can build with it, what we can manufacture with it, and how we use it here in construction in Southeast Alaska.
About a decade ago, the U.S. Forest Service amended the Tongass Timber Management Plan to transition timber harvesting from predominantly old growth to young growth over a 16-year period in an effort to preserve the ecosystem and support habitat restoration. Young growth timber is wood harvested from forests that have naturally regrown in areas previously logged. The trees are around 50 years old, as opposed to old growth, which can be hundreds. Tomes says figuring out how to do sustainable timber management is a key part of the work they do at the Conservation Society.
On the Tongass, there's places that we should protect and not touch. There's places we should leave alone because they produce salmon for our fisheries. There's places that are important for wildlife, and there's areas where we have to figure out how do we do timber harvest and rotational forestry.
And that's where the learning shelter comes in. Tomes says this project shows the potential for local timber to support community development. Once completed, it will be a 24 by 30 foot open air learning pavilion with hefty beams and roofing milled from young growth timber. Pacific High principal Matt Groen says the learning shelter has been a decade in the making and is rooted in the school's experiential, place-based style of learning.
We have about two-hour classes a day for 8-week sessions. And the reason for those extended class times are to provide meaningful hands-on experiences for students, where we not just read about a concept, but we actually go out and get to the field.
Groen says the shelter will be used as an outdoor classroom and a place for students to work with vegetables grown in the garden and greenhouse and learn about processing wild foods like deer and salmon.
Whether that is on a sunny day or a rainy day, we have a guest speaker, we can go out there. If we have like a kind of hands-on project, we don't have to be doing that work inside classrooms. And now we have a clear designated space where we can immediately access that, which, I mean, saves our teachers hours of additional prep work. And so those additional hours then can be used for providing even more meaningful experiences.
And while students will be using the space to learn local skills like deer processing, it's noteworthy that they'll be doing it under a shelter made from local timber. Lumber for construction in Southeast Alaska is typically barged up from the lower 48 or Canada. Tomes says this local supply helps save on costs of shipping, materials, and construction. It also supports milling and logging jobs within the state and connects local wood products to Alaska markets.
This wood comes from Mitkoff Island, which is, 150 miles away from us. And we're not importing this lumber from the lower 48, the Pacific Northwest, or the southeastern United States. And we're using this lumber resource here in our state rather than exporting a bunch of round logs to China. So this is all part of how do we make sustainable communities, how do we create a robust economy here in Southeast Alaska, and how do we build with resources that come from our place.
Tome says many partners have been involved in laying the foundation for this years-long project. They hope to finish up the shelter by this spring. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Hope McKenney.
The North Pacific Fishery Management Council is expected to vote today on whether to set hard caps on chum salmon bycatch in the Bering Sea pollock fishery. The council has heard over 100 public comments, many from Western Alaska tribal leaders and fishermen calling for tougher limits, saying the fishery's chum bycatch is a direct threat to salmon-dependent communities. But they've also heard from another set of voices, groups warning that a hard cap could hurt coastal villages in a different way, because many of those communities are tied financially to the pollock fishery through the Community Development Quota Program. KUCB's Theo Greenlee reports.
On an August afternoon in Nikolski, nearly all 20 people who live in the small Aleutian village came out for the grand opening of a new building.
Where are we today?
We're in the community center.
That's Autumn Lestenkoff. She says that a few days before, the kids got to have a party in the new gathering place. It was fun.
Play games, win prizes, and eat food.
Infrastructure projects like this are a big deal around here, where there isn't a major employer or industry. Nikolski doesn't process pollock like its neighbor, Unalaska, the hub of the Bering Sea trawl fishery, but the money for this project still traces back to the pollock fleet. That's because of the Community Development Quota Program. The federal program gives 65 eligible Western Alaska communities a stake in the Bering Sea and Aleutian Islands fisheries. In practice, it's one of the ways pollock money ends up paying for basic infrastructure in places that don't have many other options. Today, about a third of the pollock quota in the Bering Sea is controlled by CDQ groups, like APICTA, the Aleutian Pribilof Island Community Development Association, which built this center, along with many other projects across the region.
Atka Health Clinic, power distribution upgrade projects, St. George Harbor project, salmon burying.
That's APICTA's CEO, Luke Fanning. He says that projects like this rely on the trawl sector. He says that if the North Pacific Fishery Management Council puts hard limits on the pollock fishery, it would jeopardize roughly 70% of the funding for CDQ programs.
Life in these communities looks very different if you didn't have that fishery taking place and you didn't have the kinds of benefits going to these communities that are funded by the pollock industry.
But not everyone supports the program. Declining salmon runs have led to a moratorium on salmon fishing in parts of Western Alaska, devastating subsistence communities in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. Research points to climate change as the driving factor, but many YK stakeholders have asked for stricter limits on the trawl fleet, who incidentally catches chum salmon as bycatch. The majority of stakeholders most affected by the salmon crisis testified in favor of stronger limits to the pollock fleet at the council meeting over the past week or so. But a minority warned that a cap could cut into CDQ revenue that supports those same villages. Louise Paul is a community service representative for Coastal Village Region Fund, a CDQ group in the YK Delta. She told the council that CDQ funding is essential for the group's 20 villages, especially as they rebuild after Typhoon Halong.
I am an evacuee from Kipnuk and now residing in Bethel. So for myself and my family, we plan on returning to rebuild our lives and our home. If the quota from the trawling industry with coastal villages is lowered, this will definitely affect the people and the efforts of our livelihood.
Not everyone is so black and white about it. Over in Accutane, where APICTA is completing a tsunami shelter and community center, independent scholar Haley Hanna-Stepitin says the CDQ program is central to the community and to indigenous stewardship of marine resources. But she also thinks it relies too much on extraction.
Sustainability to me as an indigenous person who lives here means that the lifeways that we have here now and that were here when my grandparents lived here remain so that future generations of Unangah people can continue to live off of it. And our living off of it is not tied to capitalism.
Stepitin says CDQ doesn't have to be an all or nothing proposition. It can be both true that CDQ money pays for things communities need and that communities should be willing to ask what the pollock fishery is costing their salmon runs. With reporting from Nikolsky, I'm Theo Greenlee.
As breweries in Alaska adjust to a legal ruling that could allow them to have unlimited live shows, a different sort of industry is also celebrating: musicians. Until last month, breweries were limited to 4 live shows a year, and before 2024, they were banned from having them completely. Now, breweries can have unlimited live music performances. And as KTOO's Yvonne Crummy reports, the ruling comes right on time for musicians and businesses to start planning for Alaska Folk Fest in April.
Marion Call is a junior musician, and as executive director of Music Alaska, she's also spent the last few years organizing other musicians across the state to advocate for the industry. She said the recent Alaska Superior Court ruling opens doors for musicians and performers.
This regulation was ultimately a regulation about when and where musicians can work. It was essentially putting a limit on how often and in what locations we can do our job.
The ruling argued that the regulations that limited live shows at breweries suppressed free speech.
It makes sense for the government to regulate various industries, but the thing that was so difficult about this particular regulation was that they were not intending to regulate the music industry. They were intending to regulate the alcohol industry.
And Call says musicians are a force in Juneau. More performances in town don't create a zero-sum game economically. Call says Music Alaska researches the economic impacts of music in communities.
Generally, what we see is that more music breeds more economic growth without necessarily undermining other sectors. We come into a space where there was no economic activity and created kind of out of thin air.
If the ruling holds, this could open doors, financially and creatively, for musicians during the city's biggest music event of the year, Call says.
I think Folk Fest excites me the most because it's really an invitation, not just for everyone to come out and listen and enjoy, but also for everyone to play. And I can't wait to see people feeling free to play anywhere without worrying about it.
Avery Stewart is a guitarist, vocalist, and writer with the local band The Rain Dogs. While meeting with a bandmate at a cafe in Juneau, he says he thinks former limitations have dampened Juneau's creative spirit during Folk Fest.
I was just recalling, like, past Folk Fest, seeing signs on the walls of distilleries because they had to put up these signs, like, do not play music here, which I thought was so silly.
He and band member Anna Mahanner said that impromptu jam sessions are an inherent part of the festival, and now there's no risk of businesses or musicians facing fines for them.
Instead, it's like, you know, you're interacting with one another by playing music, by jamming, by having it be maybe not a, like, high-profile thing, yeah. You know, but it's more casual.
It's like a communal experience rather than a performance.
Yeah.
It's just a sharing of music in its purest form.
Mahanner says she's excited to have more places to play in Juneau and different venues to suit different kinds of shows. She says she wants to be able to play for broader audiences.
I think that our sound is evolving in a lot of different ways, and we're experimenting with playing in different places. Like, there's, you know, a certain energy that you bring to when you're playing at, like, a bar or a dive bar.
And a lot of the Rain Dog shows meet that energy, loud and rowdy. But Mahanner wants to play in quieter venues, too.
And then with the idea of there being kind of more listening room styles, it's like a little bit more intimate and you can be a little bit more personal with the crowd, you know, and interact and have just a more, intimate, vulnerable experience.
The lawsuit didn't specifically include distilleries, but at a recent Alaska Alcoholic Beverage Control Board meeting, board members said they believe those businesses will fall under the same ruling and be able to have unlimited live music as well. In Juneau, I'm Yvonne Cormery.
The Alaska Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office has until February 14th to appeal the decision, but board members have so far chosen not to. For KFSK, I'm Olivia Rose.